Hello, everybody, and welcome to this beautiful, snowy Thursday morning. I am Bhavani, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll be with you for the next hour. My guest today is Vikas Mandu, who is one of the co-founders and co-directors of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United. And I'll be telling you more about him in a little while. But before I do, I just want to get started with some of the news that's been going on in our world, as well as share a recipe with you. So, this is an exciting week. I'm sure you all heard that the United States Department of Environmental Protection has stated in their environmental impact statement that the Keystone Pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline that we have all been rallying together to try to prevent from expanding and bringing oil from the tar sands in Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, that they have stated that it will have no negative environmental impact. Can you believe it? I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing. Scientists and environmentalists have been stating over and over all of the different negative impacts that it will have, and they just ignored all of the science. And, we had one of the largest protests against the Keystone Pipeline a few weeks ago in Washington. We had over, they say, between 40 and 50,000 people down there on a freezing cold day, and they're planning a really big rally this summer, so stay tuned for that. But we all have to not let up and stay on board. And you can see what the results of people coming together and protesting can be, because our state assembly in New York just voted and passed a two-year moratorium on fracking. And that is a great feather in our cap for New Yorkers against fracking. And now it's going to go to the state, and hopefully they will do the same. There's been so much momentum in this anti-fracking movement. A few years ago, I didn't even know what fracking was, and I was one of the first people to get on board. And, you know, people are still learning about what fracking is, but fracking is the process of drilling a mile down into the shale rock, and then somehow they turn the drill and they go lengthwise for miles, and they pour in millions of pounds of water and chemicals and create an explosion underground that releases the gas that's locked up in that shale rock. And at the same time, a lot of it escapes. It pollutes our air, pollutes our water. And the movie Gasland was a movie about the fracking industry. And the states that have allowed fracking have the science to show how bad it is with the people that are getting sick, with cancer, with skin rashes, with horrible, horrible medical situations. And we showed the movie Dear Governor Cuomo a few weeks ago at the Cinema Arts Center, and that's a great movie if you can see it. It's really fun because it's also a musical concert, but it talks about the devastation that fracking can have on our environment. So that's just another reason why we have to spend more money on using our brain power to come up with renewable ways of creating energy. And it can happen. You know, wind and solar are some of the ways, but there's so many brilliant people out there that are not being given the incentives to use their brain power to come up with these new creative ways that we can create energy. And so we need to put more money into that and find renewable sources. At the same time, we all have to do our part to conserve and to reduce the amount that we become dependent on gas and oil. And we all, have, myself included, have ways that we can improve the things that we do and think more about ways of conservation. So, lots of great things going on in our area. For starters, talking about fracking, this Sunday, March 10th, Food and Water Watch is sponsoring buses from New York to go out to see fracking sites in Pennsylvania. I know on Long Island they have two pickups. One is in Melville and one is in Roslyn. And the bus costs, I'm actually not sure, I think it's about $30, $30, $35 to take this bus. They also have some scholarships available. And when I was on the site recently, they still had 16 scholarships available, I believe. So if you are interested in going and seeing firsthand the fracking sites and see the devastation of what it does to these communities, it would be a wonderful event. Also on March 10th, there is an event happening out at Temple Beth David. It's called Green Faith, Ground for Hope, Long Island. And it is faith communities coming together, responding to Superstorm Sandy, and they're gathering together to learn, to network, to plan on ways that they can address these environmental changes. And it should be an interesting day. It's all day long, starting at 2 in the afternoon, I think, till 6. So you can find out more information about that and all of these things that I'm talking about on my website at ieatgreen.com. On March 13th, I will be heading up to Albany with hundreds of other people for the No Farms, No Food Rally. And I welcome any of you to come. It should be a really great day of meeting with our legislators and their aides and talking about why we need to conserve farmland and how we need to get more initiatives to save our farmland and to support young farmers to take up the trade of farming, because so many of our farmers are over 60 and are looking to retire, and we'd like them to pass those farms down to young farmers and not sell them their farms to developers, which is what's happening. So any of you that are available to spend the day up in Albany with us on Wednesday, March 13th, that would be great. On March 14th, the Sustainable Institute at Molloy is having their film series, The Island President, and that's about an island, the Maldives, which is, I think, the first island that is 100% doing sustainable agriculture. And so that should be a really interesting movie to check out. On March 15th, Slow Food Huntington, which is my local Slow Food chapter, we are having a potluck dinner, a members-only potluck dinner, to elect a board of directors. And this is really an exciting step for our local chapter of Slow Food. Slow Food, for those of you that do not know, is an international organization, and there's over 200 chapters in the United States, part of Slow Food USA. And it is a movement, push against fast food, and that's what Slow Food is about. Good, fair, safe food, good for everybody, fair labor wages, fair prices, healthy, traditional, and it's also about the joy of eating, the conviviality of coming together, of cooking a great meal, and preserving our traditions of coming together as a family and community and eating together. And so Slow Food Huntington has been, you know, is a relatively new chapter, and this will be our first time electing a board of directors, so we're really excited about that. And then on the next month, on April 21st, we'll be having a big event to celebrate and to welcome in our new board of directors. And that will be out at a new Slow Food recognized restaurant called West East Bistro in Hicksville, Long Island. And it is one of the restaurants on Long Island that is actually trying to source all their animals raised humanely, grass-fed, antibiotic and hormone-free, as well as trying to make more connections with local farmers to purchase local produce. So we're really happy to support that restaurant. The Small Farms Summit, the Long Island Small Farms Summit, which has had a great event both in 2011, 2012, has had their first meeting. We had decided months ago that we were going to skip 2013 and take a hiatus and focus more on little workshops as part of the Small Farm Initiative, ongoing workshops to continue the education and the bringing together of community to learn more about sustainable agriculture, and to work hard on bringing a new small farm summit for 2014. So as part of these ongoing workshops, Fox Hollow Farms, along with the Long Island Small Farm Initiative, has put together a series of four garden workshops. And the first one is a garden skills workshop, basic vegetable gardening for beginners. That's March 23rd. Then on April 6th, their next one is going to be about starting seedlings. And then on April 20th, the next one will be about how to build a raised bed. And then the last one is how to use backyard tools, and that will be on May 4th. So these are four workshops to help the beginner farmer get started. We are also sponsoring Lorna Donaldson, who is coming up from Kentucky, I believe, or Tennessee, I'm actually not sure. She's coming east and hosting many workshops on straw bale gardening, which is a great way of gardening when you don't have the land or the resources to build raised beds, or if you're going to be moving from one year to the next. Straw bale gardening is a really easy way to just get started quickly. And she's going to be giving workshops all over the East Coast area, the New York area. And I will be hosting one here at IE Green on March 20th in the afternoon at noon, from noon to 1:30. And you can also register for that on my website. And then later in the day, she's also going to be doing a workshop, The Hows and Whys of Organic Gardening, and that's a free workshop at the Waterwell in Huntington. So there's so many, as you can see, there's so many things going on. Of course, there's the Just Food Conference also coming up March 29th and 30th at the Food and Finance High School in Manhattan, which will be another great event. So, you know, there's so many great things going on. Oh, and we can't forget the 6th Annual Veggie Pride Parade on March 24th. That's in Greenwich Village. And that's just a fun time for anyone, vegan, vegetarian, to come out, dress up, and march and support and help expand the vegetarian movement. So that's all great stuff. So now I want to share with you my recipe before I invite Fikak Mundu on to tell us about the work he's doing. So this recipe is a very simple, quick recipe to put on the table. Literally 15 minutes you can be eating dinner. But the thing that's so much fun about it is a new product that I discovered, black rice pasta. Now, so often when you see black pasta, it's because it's been dyed with squid ink, you know, from squid. This is black rice pasta. And it's made from forbidden black rice. So it's really great because it has no fish ink in it. And it's beautiful. And it tastes great. And they call it black rice soba noodles. So you can find them. I know I bought mine in Whole Foods. And it's just 100% black rice. So you need one package of that, which is 8 ounces, a quarter cup of olive oil, one large head of broccoli cut into florets, one onion chopped, 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, a lot of garlic, 1/4 cup white wine, salt and pepper to taste. And if you're not vegan, you can also garnish it with some Parmesan cheese. So, you know, put the water on to heat up the pasta. And while that's heating up, heat 1/4 cup of olive oil in a wok. Add the onions and cook them on medium heat for about 6 to 8 minutes so that the onions start to caramelize. You don't want to burn them. You want to cook them so that they really get sweet. Once those onions are cooked, the water's probably boiling. You can add your pasta. The thing when you're making pasta and, you know, a dish that you want to get on the table is timing. You really want to try to get it so that the pasta is coming off of the stove at the same time that your vegetables are ready. So this is just black rice pasta with broccoli. If you want to add other vegetables and make it more of a primavera, you can certainly do that. So I add the pasta to the boiling water. Then I'm going to add the garlic to my broccoli and cook for another minute or so. I added the garlic to the oil. Cook that for another minute or so, and then add the broccoli. And cook the broccoli until it begins to soften. When it starts to soften and it's a bright green color, at that point you add the wine, salt, and pepper. And the wine will help steam the broccoli right there in the wok. And just cook it for about 3 minutes till it's the right crunch for you. You don't want it too hard, too al dente, but you don't want it to be mushy and olive green either. So then you remove it from the heat, take the pasta off of the stove, drain it, and depending on whether you want to just mix it in a bowl or, you know, I'm cooking just for my husband and I, so I really just took the pasta and put it right back into the wok with the broccoli and stirred it right into the wok and served out of there, and it was just great. And like I said, if you wanted to garnish it with some fresh Parmesan cheese, you certainly can do that also. Salt and pepper to taste, of course, and voila, that's it. It is so fast, so easy, and it was so satisfying. Of course, I served it with a fresh arugula salad, which was great. So I hope you all enjoy that. Again, you can find these recipes as well as these events on my website at www.iegreen.com. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce Fakathmandu. He is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, the country's first national restaurant worker organization. And for those of you that remember, a few weeks ago I had his partner on, the other co-founder, Saru Jayaraman, and she works closely with him. Fakak is an immigrant from Morocco with over 14 years of experience in the New York City restaurant industry. And he's always been a staunch worker advocate his whole life, and his life was profiled in the book The Accidental American, published in 2008 by Barrett Kohler Press. He first came to the United States as a paid companion to a Saudi prince, then overstayed his visa and remained here permanently, changing his status from illegal to legal through marriage. Fakak served as the head waiter at the beloved union leader and a beloved union leader at Windows on the World, which was the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Centers, until September 11th, when he lost many of his friends in the unfortunate falling of the towers. So, Fakak, are you with me?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
So, welcome. So, can you tell us first what was your experience working in the industry, and what prompted you to start the restaurant union?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, first, you make me hungry with your pasta things. I cannot.
Uh-huh.
As soon as I finish, I'm going to run to have my lunch early today.
Oh, good.
So, like you said, you know, when I come to this country in the late 80s, I started working in the restaurant industry, and I was one of the luckiest one because I speak French and I work in a French restaurant. So I was promoted very quickly from a delivery boy to bus boy to waiter.
Uh-huh.
And this is not the normal. The normal immigrants and people of color will work as a busboys or dishwashers their life, 30 years, 35, till they die in the restaurant, some of them.
Uh-huh.
And it's not because they don't understand the food or they don't understand the sauces or the wines. You find them most of the time that they know every corner in the restaurant. And just because who they are, they always kept in the back of the house.
Uh-huh.
And staying in the back of the house is a big tax, you know. People that work in the back of the house or up to busboys, which immigrants and people of color, are always paid up to $26,000, $30,000 a year, while other people, or I can see people, you know, with some privileges that they were born white with blue eyes, they always put in the front, even with less experience or no experience sometime, and making... In the places where I work, I make more than $100,000 a year as a waiter.
Wow.
So it's really an unjust or tax that people of color and immigrants pay just because of who they are. It's not what their experience. And you go to any place now here in New York, and you see who's in the front and who's in the back.
Right.
So, like I said, I was really lucky. I was working in the front of the house, making a lot of money, and I thought that this is great and there is no discrimination in this country and in this industry. But 9/11 happened, and I lost 73 of my brothers and sisters that work with me, and 350 of us left with no jobs. So the smart way to do it, we just get together, and we start, looking for jobs to each other and trying to help in each other. But the problem that I saw after 9/11, it was families of people that used to work with me in the same place, but you just work in different position, having no saving at all. You know, people working in the back of the house making 280 to 320 a week. Their family have no saving. I have some of my friends that die, and their family don't have milk for their kids the next day.
Right.
So it's just like, wake me up. Like, this is unjust, and that's how I start the Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York.
Yeah, well, it's really great that you did, because obviously they are a franchise of people that are just not represented in any other organization. So it really, needed to happen. So thank you for doing that on behalf of them. And can you tell us, in your experience, did you find that most of those workers in the back, were they all legal residents and had the paperwork to have been able to be promoted, but they just were bypassed? Or I know, because you said they had the knowledge that you felt like they could have been in the front of the house.
Well, this is one of the problems that with it's they're undocumented, because we all born legal from 9 months, and we all have the same eyes and some same to arms. So they're undocumented. They come here, they overstay their visa, or they come with no visa to this country, and they get stuck here. So the industry know that those people are undocumented. Even the BLS of 2000 said that 20% of the workforce in the restaurant industry is undocumented. And they know that. Restaurant owners love that, because it's a good way for them to retaliate against restaurant workers. You know, if you are undocumented and you open up your mouth, they might fire you, or they may say, hey, I get this no match letter. You know, the immigration or the IRS will send what we call the no match. This name does not match the Social Security. And this does not happen just to immigrants or people who are undocumented. You know, most of the people that work in the restaurant industry, they are actor and stuff, so they have double names. And sometimes they work with their created name, so that name does not match the Social Security. So the IRS would send a letter that said, this name does not match the Social Security, and the restaurant owner will use that one for retaliation if they know that those people are standing up for their rights, or they're talking about their rights. They will say, I get this letter, I have to fire you. Even the letter does not say fire them, just said verify that the name matched the Social Security. So yes, people that work, there is some undocumented people that work in the industry, but that's the industry know that. It's not something that's hidden. The restaurant association is really a big, powerful association in the country, and you don't see that many raids in the restaurant just because of that power that restaurant association have.
Uh-huh. Right. But that being the... many of these people that you're talking about, they also don't speak the language. Isn't that true? Like, they don't speak English very well.
No, that's not true. Some of them don't speak, but most of them speak English. I work with, in my 17 years working at the finest restaurant in New York, I work with some folks that they are white from Europe, from Italy or France, who don't speak English, who really don't speak French, straight from Europe, working with me in the front of the house, don't speak the language, and they look at them as their accent is really exotic, it's nice, and they put them in the front.
Uh-huh.
So it's not the language, it's the look.
Uh-huh. Right, which is definitely not acceptable.
In this year, in 2013.
Uh-huh. And so can you also talk a little bit about the working conditions in the restaurant industry? You know, I know when I was interviewing Saru, she talked about that there was no insurance, no sick leave, no paid sick days off. And so very often these workers in the back of the house handling our food very often are, coming to work even when they should probably stay home.
Well, it's like everybody else. Restaurant workers get sick, like all of us, you know. When the season is here, everybody starts sneezing. And restaurant workers are human beings, so they got sick too. The problem is when they don't have a pay sick days. If they call, some places, if you call sick, you are fired, or they deduct money from your salary. So they cannot call sick. If they don't, if you cannot call sick and they come to work, they have to sneeze, you know. And where they gonna sneeze? They are working, like you sneeze in front of you for your computer. Sometimes you put your hand, sometimes you just, it's, so they may sneeze on your food, and when they sneeze on your food, you're going to eat that food. Consumer going to eat that food, and consumer going to get sick. Restaurant owner don't care about this. Also, in some other places where restaurant workers have to work extra hours or double or three times sometimes, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and they are tired. I have cases, or I witnesses cases where people slicing, in the slicer, slicing meat, you know, cut their fingers, and the blood go to the plate, and the plate was served.
Ooh.
We have other cases where consumer, you know, bit in the piece of meat, of finger, and it was in the newspaper all over the city here 3-4 years ago. So, and they keep working. It's not they stop. They keep working. If you stop, because the line is busy, the chef is yelling, the waiters want their food, the customers outside want their food.
I know. I personally have been in the back of the house, so I know. You know, as a chef, I've been back there.
It's a chaos in the back, and you cannot say, I cut my finger, then, you know, it's your fault.
Right.
So it's that's why we're fighting now, and we're trying to pass this legislation that a basic day for restaurant workers.
So tell us, what is the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United doing right now? What are some of the proposals that you're trying to push forward to get passed?
In the Congress, that we just, you know, the minimum wage, could you believe that restaurant workers, the federal minimum wage is $2.13. You know, as a consumer, we have to pay the rest. A lot of us don't tip. Some people don't believe in tipping. So that restaurant workers has to pay taxes from the food that you eat, because in the end of the year, they were taxed 13% of their income, whatever they make as selling food. So a lot of people, or European don't believe in tipping because it's included in their country. So what we're trying to push is that tip minimum wage to be 70% of the regular minimum wage, because, you know, we just, it's enough. Enough is enough. For last 22 years, the minimum wage did not move 1 cent. Restaurant Association, like I said, it's really have a big lobbying in the Congress that really pushing the minimum wage to stay at 2.13. So we are pushing for that 2.13 to be 70% of the minimum wage. So front or the back, you know, restaurants, we need a raise in the minimum wage. We are fighting for this, and this is the time, this is the moment that all of us stand for it and send the congressperson a letter or a phone that this is not enough. This should change. And also the pay sick days, like I said. You know, pay sick days is not just good for restaurant workers and the owners. It's good for consumers too, because when a restaurant worker don't have a pay sick days, or when his son is sick and he cannot stay with him one day because he cannot call in and get paid for that day, it's bad for us as a consumer, and it's bad for us that those workers, if they are sick, they end up in emergencies, and we pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
So restaurant owners should take responsibility too. So they are making money left and right. They should take responsibility and do their duties and do their fair share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I remember I used to work as a waitress as well, and I remember when I worked as a waitress, all of our tips were just, you know, money under the table. I mean, we also had low minimum wage, but we weren't taxed on our tips. And I remember when that changed, when they, you know, started to say that, okay, no matter what, whether you are tipped 20% or 10% or whatever, we are going to assume on all the food that you sell, we're going to assume that you were tipped 13%, and we're going to tax you on that.
And it's not unfair. Yeah.
You know, right, I remember, you know, hearing stories of people who were taxed more money than they were tipped. You know, you have a party that, you know, if you have a large check and your client or your customer just decides not to tip, you're still going to pay tax as if they tipped.
Exactly.
And
really, exactly.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's just so unfair. So it's great that, you know, this organization is representing this unfranchised group of workers who don't have the power behind them to stand up for themselves. So it's great.
Can I add one?
Sure.
You know, we are starting a new organization called the Welcome Table. It's the welcometable.net, where people can go. A lot of people always asking us, I don't own a restaurant, I don't work in a restaurant, but I want to help. How can I help? So we create this new website that's called welcometable.net, where people can go inside there and participate and send petitions to their selected, to the elected people, and push for higher minimum wage and basic days and other stuff. So please, people, if you can go to www.thewelcometable.net and be part of this new organization that's going to be doing the right thing. We're getting foodies and people who like food with people with workers' rights. You know, you talk about organic food and organic pasta, and we need organic workers.
Right.
It's a really a need.
Okay, well, I will share that information as well on my in my newsletter and try to get the word out there. So people, when they go to this website, they can sign the petitions right there?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, does the website also list restaurants that are treating their workers in a fair manner?
This is a really good question. We have an application, a phone application. If you have one of those smartphones, download RockUnite, the smart application, where at the application, anywhere in the country you are, you will find some good restaurants that treat their workers right. You know, it's those restaurants, they are not elected or selected by their food or by the, it's selected by how they treat their workers. And they can show you everything, you know, how much they pay minimum wage, if they have basic days, and if they do promotion within. It's not they just bring people from outside and leave people for 20 years in the back of the house. So those restaurants are all in our app, and you can download it for free, and every year we're going to be adding one more restaurant to that.
So is that app thewelcometable.net? Is the app called The Welcome Table?
No, the app is called RockUnite Diner Guide. It's the Diner Guide. So you go to it, it's free, you download it, and there is a lot of fun in it.
Because, can you say that one more time so that I can get it down, so I can make sure everybody knows it?
It's Diner's Guide.
Diner's Guide.
Restaurant Opportunity Center United. If you put just Diner Guide, they will get you to the app in search.
Okay. Diner's Guide, Restaurant Opportunities United, yes. Center United. Okay. Great. Yeah, that's so important. You know, very often, you know, we read these beautiful write-ups about restaurants that are doing all the right things and sourcing the right meat and buying vegetables from their local farmers, but they still have the inequality happening behind the kitchen door, you know. And it's really just another piece of information that, as a consumer, I know I want to know. So can you tell us, actually, you know what, let's hold this. I have a question. I want to talk about some of the models that, you know, some of the new owners are using to in their restaurants for ownership. But before we do that, I want to just take a quick break. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, maybe you can talk about some of the new innovative models that with worker ownership. Okay?
Sure, definitely.
Don't go anywhere, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Vikas Mundu. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Vikas Mundu. He is the co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. And he's working really hard to give restaurant workers in the back of the house a voice. And welcome back, Vikas. How are you?
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
Good. So before we took the break, I wanted to ask you if you could share with us some new innovative models that are starting to take place in the restaurant industry, where workers actually have some ownership in the restaurants.
Oh, yes. Just after 9/11, you know, we get a group of people from Windows in the World get together and said, let's open up a restaurant. Let's open up a co-op where all of us can be part of it, can be owners, and keep the families that used to work at Windows in the World together, the survivors of 9/11. And in the beginning, you know, we thought this is going to be easy with all the money that was poured in New York after 9/11. It was really, really hard to start this project. And anywhere we go, people will say, well, restaurants close, restaurants don't succeed, restaurant this, restaurant that. And in the end, we find out that people don't want to give us money. And foundation and money that was here coming for reasons for us, for people, for survivors and victims. Because we were all immigrants and people of color leading this new invention, and people said it's not going to work because they don't used to see people like us running their own business. So it took us, a friend of ours that used to study in Italy in Bologna, and Bologna is all co-ops. Everything is a co-op. It's a great place in Italy. So we took 18 immigrants all the way to Italy, and we sit down with our friend there, with our co-op friend, and they come up with $500,000, and they said, you know, there is $500,000 to start your restaurant in New York, but if before you get it, you should go and get another $500,000 from the U.S. If you get that, we give you this five. So we thought it's going to be easy. We have 500 people going to get, you know, they're going to give us this other $500,000. It was no way. Then it took like a lot of small places and small churches and to get the $500,000. And the restaurant cost $2.15 million, and we have half now, $1 million. We thought this, we're going to get loans so easy. No bank want to give us a loan. It took 17 small banks to get a loan of $1.15 million. And everybody said, oh, this model is going to close, this model is not going to succeed. But the problem, we proved them wrong. You know, we are open now. This is our 7 years now opening here in New York. And Color Restaurant in downtown Manhattan is not just a restaurant.
What's it called?
Colors.
Color. Oh, I've heard of that restaurant. Okay.
And Colors now, it's a school where during the day, if you go there, you find, you know, people of color and immigrants who cannot afford to go to those fancy, expensive school, coming and getting trained for free. And we train them, and we place them also at Rock New York here in New York, because there is, we are in 23 states and 26 cities. So here in New York, Rock New York, with all these trainees that train at Color, they find them jobs and they follow up the 3 months, the 6 months, and the 1 year how they are doing in the job. So it's really, really great when now going all over New York and they find people that come and train and have a job. You know, people from the Harlem up there who used to work just in McDonald's, they thought they cannot come and work in this fancy restaurant here in New York City. Now they are working there and making money, and a lot of stories that happen. And now we open also another one in Detroit, in Michigan, Detroit, where Color of Detroit is really doing great in training and also the food. You know, when it's open, you go there and there is really good food, sustainable. We try to get food from farmers here from New York. So we are opening another Color in New Orleans by the end of this year. So we're working in it. So we're doing all this model to show, like, yes, you can open up a restaurant and you can treat your workers right and you still can make profit.
So how does this model work? The people that work there have a investment in the restaurant?
Everybody who works inside is an owner. You know, you work for the first 3 months. If you prove that you're going to stay there and you're one of the good owners, you stay at the restaurant and you're an owner. If you leave, you don't take nothing with you. Somebody else may come and work as an owner. If you stay there, you're an owner, you know, there is good, you know, the salaries is good, it's better than the neighborhood, and if there is a profit in the end of the year, it's shared between all the members or all the owners.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's great. And so how does it work when it's shared between the owners? There must be a certain percentage, right? Oh, different people make different percentages, or everybody's equal?
everybody, people are equal in the share in the end of the year, but people make different salaries. Of course, a dishwasher is not a chef. We want dishwasher to be eager to be a chef one day.
Right.
So they make different salaries, and you know, the chef, of course, make.
I'm saying, so the profit that they get is based on their salary.
No, the profit it's a shares. It's not salaries. It's individual.
Uh huh.
It's shared between all the workers equally.
Wow.
Which
one? Great.
In Michigan is really different. We're inside the co-op. We have in other co-ops. Like there is a group that's making tomato sauce. There is other group who's doing pasta. There is a co-op inside the co-op, which working really, really good with a lot of good people there.
Now, are the other restaurants also going to do the training?
Oh, yes. Training is the main thing for us. You know, we want to, there is 10 million restaurant workers all over the country. So if we open up a restaurant for 40 people or 30 people, it's not enough. The only way to do it and to have an impact is to train people.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I love that model.
Sure, thanks. So come, when you're in the city, please stop by Colors.
I will, absolutely. So how do you engage employers as allies? How do you get them to embrace the new models that you're going for?
Well, since we start Rock United in 2001, or Rock New York, you know, we are working in three prongs. One prong, it's what we call the campaigns, where we go and we force restaurant owners that are doing the wrong thing, you know, to pay their workers right and to do promotion and to do stuff, and we win more than $8 million all over the city here, and, you know, there is a lot of things going on in New York City. And the second prong, it's what we call the round table. And the round table, it's a lot of good restaurateurs that believe in workers' rights. And some of them may go always with us, always to the Congress, like last week, where an owner stood up and said, you know, minimum wage has to go up, and I don't want to hire my people when they are sick. So we have those people here. We have more than 100 all over the country that's working with us together, you know, to make this business, this is a great business. There is a lot of potential in this business. I worked for 17 years there, making really great money, sending my kids to good school, having my own house. Why other people cannot do this too? Why other immigrants and people of color does not have the same opportunity as others? So we're trying to make it really good business.
Uh-huh.
And the third one, we do a lot of research. If you go to our website, which www.rockunited.org, there is, you know, we do a lot of research about the genders, where we send a person of color and the white person to the same place, so asking for a job, and you know, you can't believe what they told people of color than the white person.
Oh, of course I can. For the person of color, I'm sorry, we're not hiring now. And for the white person, sure. You know,
yes,
come on in. Start tomorrow.
For the white person, they start talking about basketball or soccer or something. And for the person of color, he starts asking them about the moon and some questions that he doesn't know. He just, you know, and the worst thing in Michigan when we did this the Great Service Divide, we sent two ladies to this restaurant on the skirts of Michigan, and the owner said, we don't hire women in this place. So it was like shocking to just know this.
Right. Well, there's a lot of restaurants that I don't know if they come out and say it, but if you look around, it's all men. You know, it's all men, male waiters. They don't have waitresses.
Which said, which really said, in the good positions in the front of the house where ladies can make really good living, can live in dignity with their kids, they cannot get to those positions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's even that way with chefs. I mean, you know, there's so many great women chefs, but if you look at the amount of women chefs that have notoriety and really get known, it's a minority, when in reality there's more women chefs than there are men. I mean, women are the ones that do the cooking, you know, in most homes and stuff. And, you know, it's the men that get the notoriety.
Well, this is coming all the way from back way when the French emperors and stuff put male to serve them, put male to cook for them, not female. And that things move here to the state and stay. stay still when a lady will be doing all the work, but the chef get the name. I'm going to Danielle restaurants, but Danielle have women working under them that doing all that good food, but they don't get the recognition of their names, and they are sous chefs or just pastry or in the cold salad making all this. You know, I work with a lot of great ladies who make really, really good food, but their names, they always stay as a sous chef if they go higher.
Right, right. You know, I know that I've read about many different lawsuits over time. You know, I know there was one with the Darden restaurant group. You know, they own the Olive Market and Red Lobster. You know, as far as what happens when workers try to take a stand and stand up against their employers for fair wages or overtime that they're due. You know, I know you hear stories of, you know, people punching out and then being asked to do more work and not getting paid for that. Can you talk a little bit about this restaurant group and the lawsuit that was going on, you know, in Florida or wherever?
Well, the Darden is the biggest restaurant in the world. You know, they have Capital Grille as fancy restaurants all over the cities, and they have Olive Garden and Red Lobster and a lot of restaurants. And their practices, it's not, you know, in D.C., for example, where the Capital Grille, they used to be like four or five people of color, black people walking in front of the house. And one day, one of the CEOs went there and saw that that's happening there, so he pulled the manager who used to be a black, and he told him to fire everybody that was black in the front. So people getting fired one by the other for no reason than their color, because he said this is not the image we want in our restaurants. And in the end, that manager also was fired. That's how we know, you know, he come and he joined the lawsuit, and he told that this is what happened to me. You know, they told me to fire all these black people that work in the front. So Darden is the example that should, you know, this is, it's the biggest restaurant in the world and should be the example that you know, there is no discrimination in hiring, puts women in the good positions, and also they are the one who pushing or keeping this minimum wage at 213. You know, they have their lobbying all over last year when the minimum wage here in New York, they are the one who paying their lobbyists to keep the minimum wage at 213.
So they're like the Walmart in the restaurant world.
Definitely, and they have one of their board used to be a CEO in the Walmart. They bring him now to the Darden. It's the Walmart of the restaurant. That's exactly.
Wow, you know, most people haven't even heard of Darden. You know, they hear of Olive Market or Red Lobster, but you don't know that there's a big conglomeration behind it.
It is. It's the biggest in the world, the biggest restaurant in the world. And, you know, they have to do the right. It's like the Walmart, exactly. They have to do the right. They have to do the right things. And that's what we are pushing. And we're going to keep pushing all the way to, we have to make them do the right thing.
You know, when you talk about lobbyists, it just seems like in all different areas, it's the money behind the lobbyists that rules policy in D.C. You know, it's not what how it should be, but it's these large conglomerations that have the money that pay the lobbyists, whether it's the meat industry, the rifle industry, the environmental, you know, or the biotech industry. I mean, they all spend money to pay off our elected officials,
and I hope
to get what they want.
I hope they use that money to pay their workers. They spend a lot of money in paying lobbyists in D.C. and all over in Albany. I hope they spend that money in salaries and in basic days. And, you know, Curtis, you know, the CEO of Darden is a black person. That his salary last year was $8 million plus bonuses, while the people that work with him salaries are $213. You know, it's a huge difference, millions of difference between the top and the bottom. So, like you said, you know, this lobbying, if they can just spend that money in their putting the wages up and benefiting everybody in this country.
Yeah. You know, I was at a restaurant the other day that, you know, serves really great food, and you know, you could tell when you were there that people were happy, the workers were happy to be there. You know, they liked their job. And I was talking to the owner, and she was just saying how, you know, the restaurant industry, you know, so many people go out to eat now, and restaurants are usually happy places. People celebrate their birthdays there and holidays there, and it's a celebratory place, and, you know, it's a place that brings out usually the best in people. And it's to everyone's advantage that the workers that are working there are also happy, because it's just going to make, you know, it's food is love, and, you know, and it just makes it, it just makes it such a healthier all-around experience if you know everybody on all levels are being taken care of.
And, you know, if you take care of your guests, you cannot, as an owner, you cannot be in every table. Your waiter is in every table. You cannot sell your food. You know, I work for 17 years, and I know if I want to sell that bottle of wine to the table, I will sell it. I will upsell. I will sell the good things in the menu. I will push for side orders. I will make the check big if I want to. If
right.
I don't want to, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
So, you know, Danny Meyer, which one of the good restaurateurs here in New York City, have his book, Sit in the Table, and he said, you have to take care of your workers if you want them to take care of your guests.
Right. And if you want them to sell. I mean, you know, sometimes I get annoyed when they try to push, you know, bottled water, you know, at a restaurant, because I know they're just trying to raise the price of the check, you know. But, you know, sometimes it's worth it because the water tastes so bad if you don't get the bottled water.
And, you know, it's good for the owner, too. You know, more you sell in, more it's good for him. Yes, am I going to get 20% of that whatever I'm selling, but the owner is getting, it's getting money. So it's good to have a happier people that working for you, believing in your staff, believing that you are good with them, than working with somebody who you don't even want to sell for them. Who most, you know, in some restaurants, people don't sell the special. They said, I'm not going to sell none of that special. They'll go to the waste. Because of the owner or the chef, it's not good with them. And they have to wake up and know what's going on in their places.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, before I have to mention that, you know, my co-founder and co-director that was in the show before, she have a really great book called Behind the Kitchen Door. And it's a must read. For, you know, and there is a story of 10 people inside there, and every person brings some problem that is in the restaurant industry and how we solve it, and how from the eyes of those restaurant workers that they are profiled in the book. It's a really great book, and Danny Glover Company is making a movie from both book, you know, my book, The Accidental American and Behind the Kitchen Door in 2014. It's going to be a fiction movie. So I want people, if they can, it's a really, really good book to read.
Yes, it is. And I recommend that also. It's called Behind the Kitchen Door by Saru Jayaraman. And really, really great book. So everybody, Fakak, thank you so much for raising the awareness of this issue for all of us Americans who need to know about it, and for the work you're doing with the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining me on the show. And to everyone out there, thank you so much for listening, and I'll be with you again next week. So have a great rest of the week. Join us in Albany if you can next Wednesday. Get on that bus to Pennsylvania and see the fracking sites and get involved. Have a great week.